Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box. Affordable, mind-enriching programs. Gildan Media presents 50 Great Myths of Human Evolution. Understanding Misconceptions About Our Origins. By John H. Rutherford. Read by Steve Manash. Preface. I find that many people have a strong desire to learn about human evolution and our origins as part of a larger interest in the human condition. There are many ways to contemplate the origin and destiny of humanity, including the arts, literature, philosophy, religion, and science. A strong education in the liberal arts teaches us that there are many different ways to consider our nature and our place in the universe. This audiobook deals with one aspect of the quest to understand the nature of humanity, using science to understand our existence as biological and cultural organisms subject to the evolutionary forces that affect all living creatures. This audiobook is not meant to be a textbook or a technical monograph. It represents my attempt as a teacher, I am a college professor, to explain a complex subject in a relatively short amount of space, and with the goal that you will go beyond my brief introductions to read and research topics of interest in more depth. Myths, mistakes, and misconceptions provide the focus for a broader treatment of the concepts, methods, and evidence for the history of our species. Above all, the study of human evolution is the study of human history in the broadest possible sense, and it applies to all of us. No matter what else separates us all, the origin and evolution of humans is a history that we all share. For a long time, I was interested in writing a trade book on human evolution, but had a hard time getting started. I have written several books, but my previous works were either college textbooks or books that wound up going into more specialized areas. Although I enjoyed researching and writing such books, I still wanted to have something on a more general level covering a wide range of topics in human evolution. For a while, I thought about trying to put together a book on the top X things you should know about human evolution, where X was usually some number between 10 and 20, but never got started. I needed a hook or a push. In January 2011, I got both a hook and a push. A longtime colleague and friend, Rosalie Robertson, who was then a senior editor at Wiley Blackwell, approached me and asked if I was interested in submitting a prospectus for a book on the 50 Great Myths of Human Evolution. After some thought, I realized that I could discuss many of the concepts of human evolution, past and present, within the structure of a book focusing on myths and misconceptions about human origins and evolution. After an extended delay due to a bout with cancer, this audiobook is the result of that initial conversation. I am grateful to Rosalie for her vision and imagination, and her patience with my questions and concerns. Thank you, my friend. I have also benefited from the hard work and dedication of many people that worked on this project at Wiley Blackwell. Thanks to Ben Thatcher and Mark Graney, who were involved in the initial submission and review process, and to Mark Calley and Tanya McMullen. Special thanks to the project editor, Roshner Mohan, for her patience with my endless questions and concerns, and to the copy editor, Alta Bridges, for keeping track of endless details and for making the text more readable. I thank those colleagues that reviewed the initial proposal. David Begun, University of Toronto, Robin Dunbar, University of Oxford, Paul Lerquin, Washington State University, Fred Smith, Illinois State University, Simon Underdown, Oxford Brookes University, and Bernard Wood, George Washington University. I am very grateful to Clark Larson, Ohio State University, for his reading of both the proposal and the entire manuscript, as well as answering specific questions. I am also grateful to Deborah Bolnick, University of Texas, and P. Thomas Schoenemann, Indiana University, for their assistance. Finally, I have to give thanks to my wife, Holly Jaffe, for support and guidance throughout this book, my career, and my life. Introduction. Myths and Misconceptions, or How and Why I Wrote This Book. What is a myth, and what are the myths of human evolution? I started giving these questions some thought several years ago when I was approached by the publisher to submit a proposal for a book to be called 50 Great Myths of Human Evolution. They had already published a book on misconceptions in psychology entitled 50 Great Myths of Popular Psychology, and were interested in publishing more books along the same line, focusing on the 50 great myths of various fields, including human evolution. I was intrigued by the suggestion, as I had been contemplating a general book on human origins and evolution for a while. However, I was a little apprehensive about how to approach the idea of myths in human evolution. Like many words, the term myth has both narrow and broad meanings. My apprehension stemmed from a narrow interpretation of myth. A narrow meaning of myth refers to the stories about Greek and Roman gods that I studied in a college mythology class. According to the online version of the Oxford English Dictionary, www.oed.com, a definition that would fit here is a traditional story, typically involving supernatural beings or forces, which embodies and provides an explanation, etiology, or justification for something such as the early history of a society, a religious belief or ritual, or a natural phenomenon. This definition does not fit with what I wanted to do with this book, as I wanted to go beyond the idea of simply examining stories about human origins, but instead wanted to look at different ideas and misconceptions regarding human evolution and, in particular, illustrate how scientific research often leads us to reject old ideas and consider new ones. In this book, I use a broader definition of myth that is closer to the second definition given by the Oxford English Dictionary. A widespread but untrue or erroneous story or belief, a widely held misconception, a misrepresentation of the truth. The myths in this book examine a number of ideas concerning human origins and evolution that fit this broader definition, focusing on misconceptions. Hence the subtitle of this book. There are different types of misconceptions that exist when discussing human evolution. Some of these misconceptions are simply not true, but persist over time, such as the popular notion that much of our species' evolution was influenced by extraterrestrials, myth number 40. Some misconceptions arise from inaccuracies, incomplete data, and/or faulty assumptions, but somehow continue to perpetuate over time. An example from human evolution is the notion that the initial development of agriculture resulted in improved health, myth 39, an idea possibly resulting from the faulty assumption that technological change in our species' evolution always results in progress across the board. Another common misconception is the idea that we no longer evolve, myth 48, a conclusion reached only if we assume that our rapid cultural change completely negates biological change. Many of the myths deal with topics that are not misconceptions at present, but refer instead to ideas that had once been considered accurate, but were later overturned because of new evidence and insights. Examples here include the idea that our early ancestor, Australopithecus, was a killer ape, myth 17, and the notion that Neanderthals walked bent over, myth 29. Other myths look at ideas that have been questioned in recent times, but still remain on the table as possible hypotheses, such as the existence of only one species of the genus Homo 2 million years ago, myth 21. These ideas are not myths in the classic narrow sense, but instead reflect shifts in consensus. Keep in mind that such shifts could in the future change further as new data become available. Ideas change as hypotheses are tested, and so might our conclusions on various myths and misconceptions. Today's myth might be tomorrow's consensus. It all depends on the evidence and the application of the scientific method. The dynamic nature of science. Science means different things to people. Sometimes we narrowly equate science and technology, such that recent developments in science often consist of lists of new inventions, drugs, and other important discoveries. This is unfortunate because this narrow definition leaves out many interesting scientific discoveries, particularly those in human evolution that have no direct or immediate practical benefit, but do inform us about the world and universe that we live in. It is also an unfortunate correspondence because, although science informs technology, that is not its only function or its essential nature. At its core, science is a way of knowing, specifically a way of knowing about the natural world, including human behavior, as dealt with by the social and behavioral sciences. Although we sometimes think of science in terms of its direct benefits or the total accumulation of knowledge, it is most importantly a process that enables us to learn more about the physical world. Aspects of the scientific method will be described in a later myth, but for the moment, we can break it down into a process of making observations, developing possible explanations for what we see, hypotheses, and testing them in some manner. Scientific evidence changes over time because this is a dynamic process as we ultimately discard hypotheses that have been rejected. In the general sense, a hypothesis is simply a proposed explanation. Some hypotheses can be supernatural, literally above nature, and invoke forces that we cannot directly perceive. To be a scientific hypothesis, we have to propose an explanation that is rooted in natural processes and is subject to testing. A key feature of the scientific method is openness to being shown wrong. This does not mean that we like to have our hypotheses rejected, we don't, or that we don't resist new ideas and interpretations, we do. It means that ultimately, we are open to sufficient evidence showing us that we were wrong, and that there might be a better way to look at things, although we might disagree with what is considered sufficient. In the jargon of the scientific method, we do not prove hypotheses so much as we fail to reject them, sort of like assuming someone is innocent until proven guilty. When a hypothesis is rejected in science, we throw it out and move on, coming up with a new explanation or modifying an old one. This is not always easy to do, as we are all subject to biases and feelings about pet hypotheses, but ultimately we will reject or modify rejected hypotheses. Or if we do not, someone else will. This is a radical way of thinking about the world. Many times we use a very different process of making decisions. We start with a conclusion and then pick data to support our established point of view. In an ideal sense, science works in an opposite manner, collecting all available evidence to test a hypothesis rather than assuming it is correct or incorrect beforehand. Of course, we are all human and are thus likely to be swayed by irrelevant information, wishful thinking, and pre-existing biases. However, as a process that is practiced by the scientific community, we can work through those sources of bias and error. We have to be willing to be wrong and say we are wrong. This is a difficult stance to make, because we often prize people for being resolute and standing for their convictions, admirable qualities, but more appropriate to moral and ethical decisions than for scientific analyses. Imagine, for example, someone were running for elected office and made a statement about subject X that, "I think that X is correct, but I remain open to the possibility that I am wrong." I am willing to bet money that this person would not be elected, as we often have little patience for people being on the fence or capable of flip-flops. In science, however, you have to be open to new evidence and ways of explaining them, provided there is sufficient evidence. As new evidence accumulates, ideas are repeatedly tested and often changed or thrown out. Some of yesterday's conclusions are now today's myths. This also means that some of today's conclusions might be tomorrow's myths. In this context, I am always concerned at some of the reaction given to new scientific discoveries that appear to reverse previous ideas and conclusions, be they in human evolution, medicine, astronomy, or some other scientific field. Some people note these changes in a negative light, pointing out previous errors in judgment and analysis, and are left wondering why anyone would pay scientists that get things wrong. Well, the truth of the matter is that this is the way science is supposed to work. Our knowledge progresses by making hypotheses and testing them out, and then throwing them out when they no longer fit the evidence. It is in this spirit that I discuss the myths of human evolution. To be sure, many of these are completely settled, in my view, but others can change depending on new data and analysis. I try to be clear throughout about my views on current consensus, as well as some additional possibilities. A warning, however, is that given the dynamic nature of science, it is quite likely that new evidence will shed further light on many of the topics covered in this book and will become out of date between the time I write these words and when you listen to them. That is what is supposed to happen. Structure of the book. I have picked 50 myths about human evolution that I find useful, particularly in teaching about human origins and evolution. There are many more that could be discussed, but I accepted the number 50 to be part of the publisher's 50 Great Myths series of books. Each myth is designed to address a broader issue of science and of paleoanthropology, the study of human origins and evolution. I have broken the book into four sections. The first part examines some general myths and misconceptions about the nature of how evolution works. The second part focuses on human origins, examining the fossil record for the time between the initial divergence of African ape and human ancestors and the beginning of the genus Homo, including the evolution of bipedalism, walking upright. The third part continues looking at the fossil record in terms of the genus Homo, those species, including us, with larger brains, smaller faces, and reliance on a stone tool technology. The fourth and final part of the book examines recent, the last 12,000 years, current, and future human evolution, including the history of different human populations. Because evolution is a cumulative process, it is best understood in a linear manner from start to finish. Although I have tried where possible to make some myths independent, everything flows much easier if you listen to these myths in sequence. If the idea of listening to 50 essays seems daunting, remember that each myth is very short. The purpose of each essay is to use a myth or misconception to introduce a general topic in human evolution and provide some preliminary background and explanation. Each myth starts with a short status statement of several sentences that summarizes the thrust of the myth, also indicating if the topic has been settled or if there is still discussion on it. Because each myth is designed to be short, do not expect these to be complete reviews. The topic of every single myth can and has filled books. The myths here are designed to be short introductions only. Although short essays have their purpose, you might find that you want more detail on the overall topic or on some of the specifics or to read someone else's take on the issue. I have provided references to the facts and ideas discussed in each myth in a series of endnotes that are listed at the end of each section. A complete list of references is provided at the end of the book, which is available as a PDF download. Many of these references are to papers in academic journals that might not be available in many public libraries, but should be available at many colleges and universities. Some are also available for free on the Internet. In general, I urge people interested in more detail on any of these subjects, or scientific subjects in general, to focus primarily on peer-reviewed journal papers and books. The peer review process means that others in the field have examined the papers in terms of the soundness of the data, analyses, and arguments made. Peer review is a form of quality control, and a researcher has to convince his or her peers that they have made the case for a particular conclusion. This is critical in modern times where anything and everything can be distributed on the Internet, often without any review. This does not make things on the Internet necessarily incorrect, but you have no guarantee of accuracy either. Peer review helps, as does looking at web pages that are connected to well-established scientific journals, magazines, and organizations. Unless, of course, you subscribe to the notion that the scientific community consists of individuals involved in conspiracies, in which case, I am not sure you will enjoy this audiobook. Chapter 1. Ideas about Evolution. In order to explore the myths of human evolution, we need to start with a brief review of how evolution works. It turns out that many of the myths of human evolution are related to misconceptions about the process of evolution in a general sense, starting with what is likely the biggest one of all, that evolution is just a theory. This section of the book examines some common misconceptions of the process of evolution. Myth number 1. Evolution is a theory, not a fact. Status. This is a myth based on a misunderstanding about the use of the word theory in the natural sciences. When we state something as a theory, such as evolutionary theory, atomic theory, or the theory of gravitation, we are not suggesting that it may or may not exist. A more popular use of the word theory. Instead, we are talking about a hypothesis that has been tested repeatedly and has stood the test of time without being rejected. Of all the myths about evolution, Perhaps the one we hear more than any other is the idea that evolution is a theory and not a fact. Most often, this myth is expressed as the statement, "It's just a theory," or the somewhat longer, "It's a theory, not a fact." By contrasting fact and theory, we are forced into an either-or situation. Either evolution is indeed a fact, or it is a theory. We then must choose between one side and the other. According to popular logic, if we accept evolution as a theory, then it is not necessarily a demonstrated fact. The logic works here only if we define the word theory as an unsupported or unproven hypothesis or explanation. In other words, if we classify evolution as just a theory, it implies that evolution may or may not exist. In terms of human evolution, that aspect of evolution that tends to upset folks more than, say, elephant evolution because it is personal, the statement that evolution is just a theory means that humans may or may not have evolved. If we cannot tell, then evolution, including human evolution, is therefore not a fact. It is, according to this logic, at best an opinion. Although much of what I just said may seem logical and perfectly reasonable, the argument rests on an underlying assumption that theory means an untested hypothesis or mere opinion, and that something can be either a fact or a theory. It turns out that our more popular use of the word theory is not what it means in the context of scientific thought. Evolution is actually both a fact and a theory. In my introductory course on biological anthropology, I asked the class on the first day to raise their hands if they think evolution is a fact. I then asked the class to raise their hands if they think evolution is a theory. I then tell them, "Congratulations, all of you are correct. Evolution is both a fact and a theory." This statement can cause some consternation in anyone who is used to facts and theories being considered in terms of an either-or proposition. In order to see the mistake being made by this proposition, we need to consider a bit of the underlying philosophy and method of the natural sciences and explore briefly what we mean by fact, hypothesis, and theory. To most of us, the definition of fact is pretty straightforward. A fact is a verifiable truth, something we can all observe and agree on. The key feature here is that facts must be capable of being verified. If I say that there are trees in my yard, you can actually look and see if this is true. Some facts are easy to verify, and we will all agree with little or no argument. For example, if we drop an object, such as a pencil, it will drop to the ground. We call this fact gravity. Sometimes, facts are contingent upon a more exact definition. In the case of gravity, the pencil would have to be dropped while standing on something of sufficient mass to generate sufficient gravitational force to attract the pencil. Sometimes facts are tricky because they are not directly observable with our senses. We can easily see a pencil dropping, but what of the fact that infectious diseases are caused by bacteria and viruses that are not visible to the human eye? Of course, we easily accept the existence of such microorganisms because we have developed microscopes and other technology to make our observations. However, imagine you were alive during the 14th century and someone explained to you that the Black Death, bubonic plague, was caused by a bacterium, something that could not be seen except with a microscope that had not yet been invented. I suspect that most people at that time would have rejected this idea because the plague bacterium could not be observed with the naked eye. Observing something, either directly with our senses or with technology, is a start in establishing a fact. But you need to remember that facts must be verified.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?